Welcome to Simple Living Works Podcast. I'm Jerry Iverson. It's my pleasure to be your host with my guest, Hazel Henderson of Ethical Markets Media. After the conversation in this episode, I'll report on some new services we're offering. If you're new to this podcast and would like more basic information about Simple Living Works, please listen clear to the end. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye at my cue. Ethical Markets is an independent media company promoting the emergence of a sustainable, green, more ethical, and just economy worldwide. With the motto, 40 years of foresight, insights, and integrity, Ethical Markets researches, assists, and reports on all the new organizations, civic, nonprofit, and for-profit, as well as individuals working for the transition to the new economies of the dawning information-rich solar age. Hazel Henderson is the founder of Ethical Markets Media and the creator and co-executive producer of its TV series. She is a world-renowned futurist, evolutionary economist, a worldwide syndicated columnist, consultant on sustainable development, and author of the Axiom and Nautilus award-winning book, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, and 8 other books. She co-edited the UN Policy and Financing Alternatives and Planetary Citizenship. Her editorials appear in 27 languages in 200 newspapers syndicated by Interpress Service, Rome, New York, and Washington, D.C., and her book reviews appear in Seeking Alpha, a London-based market e-letter. Her articles have appeared in over 250 journals, including in the U.S., Harvard Business Review, New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, and others internationally. Her books are translated into 8 languages, and she sits on the editorial boards, including the State of the Future Report and E, the Environmental Magazine, Resurgence, and Foresight and Futures. Since becoming a full-time media executive in 2004, Hazel has stepped down from many of her board memberships, and she remains on some others. The first version of her Country Futures Indicators, or CFI, an alternative to the gross national product, was co-created with Calvert Group, Incorporated, now renamed the Ethical Markets Quality of Life Indicators. She created the Green Transition Scoreboard, the Ethical Markets Initiative on Transforming Finance, and the Ethic Mark Award for advertising that uplifts the human spirit and society. In addition, she's been the Regents Lecturer at the University of California, Santa Barbara, held the Horace Albright Chair in Conservation at the University of California, Berkeley, and advised the U.S. Office of Technology Assessment, the National Academy of Engineering, and the National Science Foundation. She holds several honorary Doctor of Science degrees. She is an active member of the National Press Club in D.C., the World Future Society USA, a fellow of the World Future Society Federation, and a member of the Association of Evolutionary Economists. She's received many awards. Now, here's Hazel, recently recorded.
Well, Hazel, the motto of Ethical Markets is 40 years of foresight, insight, and integrity. 40 years. That predates your TV show. It predates the internet. Give us a brief history, a brief background of how Ethical Markets came to be. I understand you're a co-founder, and how that's evolved over the years.
Well, it's really, of course, based on my 40 years of writing, you know, 10 books and counting, and the realization back in 2004 that the mainstream media, particularly the mainstream financial media, were not going to be able to track the great transition that I had been tracking from the fossil fuel era to what I call the solar age. You know, the knowledge-rich, cleaner, greener economies based on efficiency and that we all really knew were possible. But this was being held up by all of the advertising that supports the mainstream media coming from what I call the fossilized sectors. So in 2004, we launched Ethical Markets Media, which is now a certified B Corporation. and basically realized that after the first series we did, which was sent to PBS stations around the country, and about 50% of them did air the first series we did of 13 programs, but we realized that for us it had to be the internet. And so all of our TV shows now, and we're on Series 8, are all distributed globally to the audience we really want to reach, and that is business schools around the world and colleges and public libraries. And so we have this very specialized audience, and it enables us to do these programs very inexpensively. We do them right here, and this is our home, and we're a typical mini multinational operated out of our garage. And we have our studio here, and it's just basically talking heads, and it costs 1,000 times less than all of the old-fashioned over-the-air TV. So that, in a nutshell, is what we've been doing, and really incorporating all of my work over the years. And here I am at my age, sitting at a computer 6 hours a day, doing content management and basically sorting out all of the 500 or so emails that come into us every day with the good news of the green transition going on all over the planet. So we kind of report the good news that you won't see on any of the financial shows.
Well, now, we have listeners that are a variety of places in life. Tell us, what is a B Corporation?
A B Corporation is now very widely accepted in many states, which allows you to say right up front that you're not in business to maximize profits or to reward only the shareholders, but to balance the rewards with society and all of the stakeholders, including the community and environmental protection. And you get recertified every 2 years. So it's quite a rigorous process. And so we are very happy. We're on our second round of certification. And it's now become a real kind of corporate good housekeeping seal. And there is a magazine called Bee, for B Corporations, and so it's moving now very rapidly around the world. There's many B Corporations in Latin America, and many, many in Europe.
Speaking of Latin America, I understand that you have quite a bit of activity in Brazil.
Yes, I was teaching at a business school there for about 10 years after President Lula took office. And the first thing we did down there, I helped to organize a conference in Curitiba, in southern Brazil, called the First International Conference on Implementing Indicators of Sustainable Development and Quality of Life. And it all relates back to my lifelong criticism of the GDP, cash-based measurement, which purported to look at the quality of life and progress of a country in these very, very narrow cash flow-based terms. And so it was an amazing experience. This was in 2003. And we put together this conference, and 700 statisticians who had been laboring in the basements of all of these statistical agencies around the world arrived and fell into each other's arms and shared all of the statistics they had on poverty gaps, education, all of the things that GDP doesn't account or pay attention to, including, of course, the love economy, which had been a focus of mine, and that is the 50% of all productive activity, which is unpaid. And, of course, largely done by women. And it wasn't until 1995 that the United Nations actually took a stab at this, and they came up with the figure of $16 trillion that year, 1995, of unpaid but very productive work all over the world simply missing from the annual GDP number that year, which was $24 trillion. So if the unpaid work had actually been recognized and acknowledged, it would add it to global in GDP and brought it up enormously to almost $40 trillion. So basically, the Human Development Index sort of took off after that and is a much broader measure. But basically, I haven't been successful yet in unseating GDP, even though it's been a lifelong mission.
What then are the Calvert-Henderson Quality of Life Indicators? I assume that was named partially for you. And how are they useful for wise investing?
Well, that was a project that I began in 1995 with the Calvert Group, where I had been an advisor on their advisory board, their advisory council, they call it. And what we had been developing since 1982, when they were founded, was screens to screen out from their mutual fund portfolio companies with bad records in pollution or manufacturing weapons or unfair to workers and all of those things. And I managed to persuade the management after a long effort, actually, that to do quality of life indicators was kind of the next thing, that you could look at corporations and you could pick out cleaner, greener, more ethical, responsible corporations. But then that still meant that they were under the GDP kind of regime of maximizing money income as the main measure. And it was the same thing with nation states and all government agencies everywhere in the world. And so I managed to persuade them finally that we had to move to the next level and do the same kind of analysis for countries and GDP. And so we developed together, Calvert and I, the Calvert-Henderson Quality of Life Indicators with their research department, and we brought out the first version of it in the year 2000. And we could not get any mainstream media to cover it. It was extraordinary because, you know, we were profit-making. I mean, Calvert is a profit-making financial company, and even Calvert couldn't get any publicity for this. It was so so different that reporters couldn't really shift their own paradigm to look at it. So eventually, what we did was the Calvert Group gave it and the copyrights to it back to me, and we rebranded it the Ethical Markets Quality of Life Indicators. And the only thing we update on a monthly basis now are the employment figures. And we try to dispel some of the misunderstandings in the macro economy figures about unemployment, you know, that people are dropped from the unemployment rolls if they've become discouraged and looking for a job, and the different employment levels between different ethnic groups. For example, our level right now is in the 4.7% range, but for African Americans, it's about 8%. So it's now a much less that we put much less time into it because there are so many other useful things now that can be done. But it can be, it's on our website at ethicalmarkets.com.
Well, Hazel, our colleague John DeGraff, who produced, of course, the Affluenza video and co-wrote the Affluenza book, is promoting the Happiness Index. Do you see any comparison or any similarities between your indices and the Happiness Index?
Oh, absolutely. And I remember meeting John at that same meeting where I first met you that Vicki Robin had. And yes, very much so. In fact, when we did the meeting in Curitiba, Brazil, back in 2003, I invited the Gross National Happiness people from Bhutan, and they presented for the first time there in Brazil. And what was so interesting was that we had a seminar for Brazilian journalists, and to explain to them, you know, the problems with GDP that are all so well known now. You know, it doesn't have an asset account, and that's why it overstates the indebtedness of countries and all of that kind of thing. And what happened was that they were so entranced by the idea of a happiness index that that was the only thing that got covered. And then a couple of years later, I was working with the European Commission on a conference that we put together there called Beyond GDP. That was in 2007. And it was really funny because even though we had all of the machinery of the European Commission to work with, it was a very similar thing that Reuters and BBC and all of the financial press, they all said to us, well, the only thing we're interested in is the happiness index. And so I realized, oh dear, you know, this is so typical of mainstream media. You know, they sort of grab onto one thing. And so from that point on, I became a bit dubious about happiness indexes or whether they were going to be captured by the mainstream media and turned into another kind of branding exercise. But I was very happy to see that the UN back in 2012 did actually bring the people from Bhutan. And they had a conference in New York. And so, of course, I'm very supportive of whatever widens people's lenses and gets them to think beyond pure money to all the things that we really value, which, of course, go way beyond money metrics and way beyond the economics profession.
Well, Hazel, we've known about SRI, socially responsible investing, for a long time, but sometimes we get the impression that if you put your money in SRI, you're sort of sticking it over in a corner. But SRI has become also now a method for advocates who want to invest in corporations to change them from the inside.
Yes, the evolution of socially responsible investing is, of course, you know, part of my life story, beginning when I joined Calvert in 1982, when we began to develop these different screens. And of course, what happened now with so many copycat funds, and the evolution changed. In the U.S., we stopped using the word social because of the feeling in this culture that anything social might be, quote, socialist, unquote. And so then it got called responsible investing. Then it got called double bottom line investing, then triple bottom line. And the latest is ESG, which is environmental, social, and governance performance. And now the most mystifying of all, which I still feel is not such a good idea, is that they now call it impact investing. And so the problem with that, in the effort to kind of take it mainstream and make it more interesting to mainstream, pension funds and whatever, you've lost so much definition now that the point that I kept making, to the Rockefeller Foundation, who started this whole impact branding, rebranding, was, look, every investment creates an impact. And some blow the tops off mountains, and some pollute the Gulf of Mexico. What is it you're trying to say? Why don't you come clean and say what it is that you're really trying to do here? And so that is a debate that's going on as we speak. Now we get where BlackRock, one of the largest global asset managers, managing $3 trillion, as if anybody could manage $3 trillion worth of assets, they now have an impact fund. Goldman Sachs has an impact fund. And I'm thinking, oh dear, now we're back to greenwashing. And so what ethical markets does really, we are a standard setting group. And the only way you can set higher global standards for capitalism and markets is basically if you do it on a media platform like we are, so that you can set the highest bar and then promote it through your network of networks. We're not retail. We're not trying to promote this to Joe Sixpack. We are a global network of global networks who are all interested in these kind of issues, from individual investors to fossil-free portfolio asset managers to pension fund asset managers to NGOs to trade unions to all kinds of groups like the Green Economy Coalition, which we are a member of, which is the largest global coalition of activists and trade unions on promoting the green economy. So this is basically what we look at all the time. And any time we have promoted a standard for socially responsible investing or ESG or whatever you want to call it, we like to keep raising the bar. And so we work a lot with accountants. In fact, I find it's much more rewarding to work with accountants who actually are doing the job of evaluating corporate performance than with economists who are up there in their ivory towers bloviating to each other. And so the Global Chartered Accountants Institute, for example, which I have worked with quite a lot. If you go to CIMAglobal.com, you can find those people. And they put out a magazine called Financial Management. And in their May and June issue last year, they had a whole issue on changing values. And what they were really, they had articles from all of the big accounting firms, and they were saying, okay, we get it now that there are six forms of capital, of which financial capital and cash is only one. And the others, of course, are built capital, that's like factories and stuff, intellectual capital, social capital, human capital, and environmental capital. And so they see their job now as measuring the performance of corporation, looking at the extent to which they either enhance or degrade all six forms of capital. And so that's the kind of paradigm shift which is going on really as we speak, but the mainstream media doesn't notice.
One of your big efforts is to reform capitalism. Now, some people may get threatened by that and say that, oh, you're a socialist. So I'd like you to, I don't have a problem with socialism. I'm not indicate that.
Nor do I, but in this culture, we do.
Maybe if you can draw some distinctions or between so that those people who are nervous about socialism will understand what you're doing?
Well, here's the way we retrain asset managers. We hold seminars and retreats here twice a year, basically retraining asset managers, because you know you have to move from the corporate level, because corporations are simply puppets of finance. It shouldn't be that way. It should be the other way around. But global finance now is so powerful that I call it the flywheel of social and environmental destruction on the entire planet. So almost everything that those asset managers learned at the Harvard Business School or wherever it was, and the financial models they were taught are simply wrong. And so we now have to go beyond what I call economism and all of those models in the still taught economic textbooks to earth system science. And so what we teach really is we will say to asset managers, and many of course are the pioneers that I interview on my TV shows, these are the ones who are creating fossil fuel free portfolios that are successfully focused on green and more efficient solar, wind, geothermal, all of the new energy sources, which are the next transition for human societies. And so I crunched it all down into a book I wrote in 2014 called Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. And the tagline underneath that was Beyond Economism to Earth System Science. And basically what I was saying to asset managers in the way they have to to change their models is, okay, when you guys were investing in fossil fuels, you had to learn geology, yes? Well, yes, they had to learn geology. Okay, now if you want to invest successfully with the way the planet functions, you have to learn Earth system science. And for the first time in my life, I became connected with the group at NASA, and they're part of a world group of 120 Earth-observing satellites that bring us real-time information about the way our planet takes the photons, which are our only source of income, from the sun, and how the plankton in the ocean take that, and the green plants take it and turn it into the human food supply. And this is the way the planet actually functions, and there's no way of being an investor successfully anymore without understanding this Earth system science. So this, I'd be happy to make it a free download. It's only 56 pages, and I'll make it a free download on our site for anyone that you have in your audience, Gerald.
Thank you so much. Yes, I see it's available as a PDF.
Yes.
At ethicalmarkets.com.
Right.
You've been listening to my conversation with Hazel Henderson of Ethical Markets Media. You're welcome to share your thoughts on these subjects. Email a message to simplelivingworks@yahoo.com or on our Facebook page or the Simple Living Works blog. Those addresses are given in the show notes and at our website, simplelivingworks.org, click in window number 3. Also, it really helps our visibility when you give Simple Living Works a 5-star review on iTunes. My colleague Lee Van Ham's new book has been released. Lee's the executive director of Jubilee Economics. Entitled From Egos to Eden, Our Heroic Journey to Keep Earth Livable, it's volume 2 of Lee's trilogy called Eden for the 21st Century. I've read an advanced copy, reviewed it, and highly recommend it. Lee and I talked about Volume 1, called Blinded by Progress, and Volume 2 on podcasts. The links to those episodes are given in the show notes. We've started a new service in 2017 called Simpler Living Sanity Suggestions. Amid all the changes in our country, we offer a new suggestion each week, not as a placebo, but as encouragement to do something for yourself, your family, your community that may counteract any negative stuff that may be coming or happening now. The suggestions are given in the Weekly Nudge. The Weekly Nudge and the Weekly Digest together make up the Simple Living Works blog. Also, a link to all the sanity suggestions is given in the show notes. I started a little campaign recently as a response to regressive policies in D.C. and many of the states called I Buy Blue, How About You? Click the link in the show notes or subscribe to the Simple Living Works blog and simply send us an email headed Subscribe Blog. Then confirm your subscription when his confirmation email arrives. I blogged recently that we were changing our long-standing alternate celebrations to non-conform freely celebrations because the terms alternate and alternative had been compromised by the new buzzwords alternative facts in D.C. So I started a short series called, appropriately enough, Banishing Fake News. You can also read each little installment in the Simple Living Works blog or read most of it on the Simple Living Works site. See the link in the show notes. I hope these new short features add positively to the national conversation about social change and support the voluntary simplicity movement. After reading them, your comments are welcome. Need a nudge? I've been producing today's Simpler Living Nudge for almost a year now and welcome you to subscribe for free. Receive it by email or Twitter. Just send me an email with the subject nudge at simplelivingworks@yahoo.com. I've received a lot of interesting responses, which you can read on the simplelivingworks.org site. Click on Recent Comments in window number 5, or see the link in the show notes. We've simplified our blogs for this year. The Weekly Nudge focuses only on the efforts of Simple Living Works. The Weekly Digest includes the latest posts from colleague organizations. Both come with a free subscription to the Simple Living Works blog. The more complete, almost obsessively detailed monthly digest is now updated at least once a week and kept on the Simple Living Works site. Links to the monthly digest are given in both the Weekly Nudge and the Weekly Digest. We hope you'll check it out, but we don't want you to be overwhelmed by the amount of help available toward a life of voluntary simplicity, which young adults now are inclined to call minimalism. Time to wrap up this episode of Simple Living Works podcast. If you're new to Simple Living Works and would like more basic information, please listen a little longer. If you're a regular, you may want to say goodbye here. Peace. If you haven't already subscribed, we hope you will through iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Remember, you can listen to all episodes of Simple Living Works podcast. They're archived twice. Access them at simplelivingworks.org, window number 3. Click Preview, Backup, and choose the episodes you want with or without show notes. Subscriptions to this podcast and to our weekly blogs are free, and they keep you current automatically when we post something new. Urge your friends to do the same. Remember to like us on Facebook. You can also subscribe in iTunes to my other podcast, The Common Good Podcast, which I produce and co-host with Jubilee One Earth Economics. Send us your email address to receive the free monthly Simple Living Works e-news. Thanks to the band Earth Mama and to John Pitney for the music on the show. This podcast is covered by the Creative Commons Non-Commercial Attribution Share Alike license. To learn more about Creative Commons, click on its link on our website homepage. We do not solicit or accept donations, nor do we sell anything. All our resources and services are free of charge. We're an all-volunteer organization. We at Simple Living Works believe that simple living really does work. Voluntary simplicity, choosing to live simpler lives, is a faithful, satisfying, effective, comprehensive way of life. It's not a list of rules nor living on the cheap. It avoids fads, convenience, and deprivation. It's so much more than a hobby. We believe in abundance, that there's enough for everybody's needs, not anybody's greed. We follow the saying, live simply that others may simply live, as our closing theme song proclaims. It's a balance of personal responsibility and advocacy for just public policy. It's more than personal happiness, though that's quite important. Contemporary faith-based simple living is based on the 5 life standards of living more with less, the classic by Doris Jansen Longacre. I've discussed those standards in earlier episodes. The mission of Simple Living Works is equipping people of faith to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly. We extend the mission and resources of the nonprofit organization Alternatives, which served from 1973 to 2011. The three parts of our mission are elaborated in text and video. Links are listed in the show notes. We produce a half-hour podcast twice a month, hopefully educational and inspiring for you, your family, and your congregation or group. Until next time, this is Jerry Iverson of Simple Living Works podcast, wishing you well as we strive to challenge consumerism, live justly, and celebrate responsibly.
Simply live, learn to live simply so others can live.